Now, a lone helicopter passes through a dim sky. A title appears, Mayday. As dawn rises, the chopper passes a control tower. Words appear, Wake Island, 2100 miles west of California. As the helicopter lands by a Humvee and military truck, a clean-cut naval officer, indoors, watches a ground crewman outside waving the helo in. The crewman jogs over to the chopper and opens the door for a stout man in a civilian suit. The visitor crosses the tarmac carrying a briefcase and shakes a waiting officer's hand. Both men face the airfield, where an F-18 gets towed forward, its canopy open above a pilot's head. The clean-cut naval officer inside stays put, surveying the airfield. Out on the tarmac, the stout visitor and his greeter stride toward the tower. This program has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH with funding from CBS. Described by Matteo Warren Lane, Christopher Flowers, and Stacy Perlman. Read by Kim I. Guest. Now the sun shines on the Golden Gate Bridge. In the San Francisco International Airport, a rugged man strides along using a cell phone. A teenage boy straggles behind him.
Well, that being said, you better clear next week too, then. And ask Raymond in the design department to email me the blueprints of the factory. Okay?
Can I just have the keys?
When I know I'm on the flight. No, I'm gonna make it. No, I'm just talking to my kid. I'm gonna make it.
Dad, this is Bo.
Doug? Have him forward me the steel specs then, okay? Hi, can you tell me what time flight 52 arrives?
11:15 a.m. Tokyo time. Any bags to check?
No, just carry on, okay?
They were already boarding you.
Now two dogs sit in kennels.
I hope they'll be all right.
Come on, Dad, you can worry just as easily on the plane as in here. Let's go.
A husband, wife, and two teenage girls head off.
I don't care whose birthday it is or how hard it was to get the tickets. The SATs are next week, and you are locked inside until then.
But it's okay for me to be your driver?
Don't be a smartass. You wanted the car, so you're dropping me off.
Yeah, whatever.
It's not whatever. We had a deal, and you have to live up to your end of the bargain.
It's not a deal. You want me to go to college, and that's that.
Yeah. I want you to have options.
All right, I gotta go. I'll call you when I land, see if you need any help.
Yeah, you mean you'll check up on me.
The rugged man hugs his son.
That's the way you want to look at it. Hey.
He jiggles the car keys.
Forgetting something?
John tosses them to his son, who catches them and smiles.
This is the final warning call for Pacific Mobile's Flight 52 to Tokyo. Passengers must proceed immediately to gate 24.
Now a three-member team mans a jet's cockpit.
Electronic checklist. Check and complete. Hydraulic panel.
Set.
Weather radar.
Operational. Storm front's brewing 1,500 miles out.
A screen between the pilot and co-pilot displays a text message. You are carrying two golden retrievers in cargo.
David, call Sharon. Let's get the show on the road here.
You bet. Hey, Sharon, we all set back there?
Just one more straggler coming through the gate, and then we're good to go. I know, it's always in my section.
Now John boards the plane.
Excuse me, sir. Can I see your boarding pass?
Yes.
You're right up these stairs.
Good morning, folks. This is Captain Williams. Welcome aboard Pacific Global Airlines nonstop service to Tokyo. We'll be getting underway in just a couple of minutes. Take your seats, relax. We'll have you there before you know
it. Made it.
Can I take your jacket?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Keep you looking fresh for when we land?
A little late for that.
What do you need to drink?
Yes, but I better have a coffee because I got work to do.
Okay.
Maybe later.
Now the co-pilot holds a photo of a boy.
Okay, Dex, Daddy has to go now, buddy. Yeah, that's right. Time to fly the plane. Okay. I love you too, pal. Bye-bye. Sorry, it's...
Well, that's okay. Daddy.
The navigator unlocks the cockpit door. Sharon enters.
Hey, guys.
Hey, everything okay back there?
Yep. Anything else I should know?
Yeah, we're carrying a couple of golden retrievers down below.
The navigator prints the text message.
And a Mr. Stein in 7B has permission to look in on them mid-flight. No problem. Are you done with this, Dave?
Yeah, thanks, Sharon.
Okay, guys, let's get going here.
Sharon returns to first class.
Ground control. Pacific Global 52 ready for pushback from gate 6.
San Francisco Air Traffic Control.
Roger, Pacific Global 52, you are clear for takeoff.
Back on board.
Yeah, well, he didn't just leave you alone, he left me too.
A blonde teenager uses her cell.
We're about ready to take off. You're gonna have to shut that off now.
Hey, Mama, I gotta go. The phone cop says I have to hang up now.
In the main cabin, Mr. Stein's girls peer over his seat back.
What's the difference? It's all the same.
Exactly, so you Mom won't mind switching. Please. The curly-haired teenagers swap seats with their parents.
All right.
Sorry, but you're gonna have to take your seats now.
Okay.
The girls smile at their mother and settle in with teen magazines. A female and male flight attendant make a final check.
Okay, folks, please turn off your cellular phones and electronic devices. They're no longer permitted this time.
Now a stylish woman snatches a PDA from a nervous young man across from her.
Okay, that's going off now.
I was looking at the proofs of the menu. You know, if there's a problem with the layout, we're not going to have time.
Can you relax for 1 second, please? It's all under control, all right?
No. No, it's not, okay? We open in 3 weeks. And there's always the if factor. What if we lose our maitre d', if the coolers don't arrive.
If you don't shut up.
Where'd the flight attendant go? I just want to confirm we have the conference room.
A male flight attendant shuts a conference room door.
Flight crew, please take your seats to prepare for takeoff.
Did you figure you're from the same gene pool?
He was swimming in the shallow end.
What? Huh?
The stylish woman smiles between a hip guy and her nervous brother.
Tower, this is Pacific Global 5-2, ready for takeoff.
In the control tower, the fatigue controller radios back.
Roger, Pacific Global 52, you're cleared for takeoff.
The captain pushes 4 jet throttles simultaneously. He and David face forward as the plane accelerates down the runway. In first class, John takes a deep breath. In the main cabin, the blonde teenager bites her lip, and the nervous man nods to himself. As the Concorde-style jetliner takes the air, the Stein family looks out of their windows, now with the captain.
Gear up.
Roger.
Gear coming up.
Flaps up.
Flaps up.
Engage yaw damper.
David hits a button labeled YD.
Yaw damper engaged.
Oakland Center, this is San Francisco Tower, handing off Pacific Global Flight 52.
Flight 52, you are leaving Tracon airspace, entering Oakland Center airspace.
Please make contact with Oakland Center at 132.05. Have yourselves a good flight.
In the cockpit, the captain turns a knob.
Oakland Center, this is Pacific Global 52, climbing to a flight level of 65,000 feet.
Estimated cruising speed, 930 knots.
Roger, 52, radar contact. You are clear to flight level 650 via flight planned route to Tokyo.
Controller in a dim room confirms, and flight 52 climbs upward. Now words appear. Wake Island Missile Test Facility. Rows of identical steel desks fill an open floor, each manned by a soldier in khaki dress. An American flag hangs on a far wall. Behind large windows, the stout visitor watches the office. The clean-cut officer joins him.
You kept a tight lid on this?
The men in this room and the pilots in the air. That's it, Admiral.
Commander, the pilots are standing by, waiting the commencement of the missile test.
Very well.
A computerized map table highlights a circular region far out at sea, west of the California coast.
Is this the projected range of the missile?
500 miles, sir.
If the Phoenix missile is successful, it will double the range of any air-to-air missile in production.
That's an awfully wide berth.
Yes, sir, but we're going to need it. When the target drone drops from the C-130, it'll climb to an elevation of 65,000 feet and establish a circular pattern. The F-18 will be moving at Mach 1 when it targets the drone. The missile will be moving and accelerating at better than 1 mile per second by the time it hits the target drone. It's a lot of elements at play, sir.
Now, with the lack of a warhead, will it affect the missile's accuracy?
No, sir. We've replaced the warhead with a titanium replication. Targeting will remain exact.
Commander, the C-130 is reporting rough weather moving in.
We've had a storm hovering out there all day.
Should we consider postponing?
It's just another variable for the missile, Admiral.
On the map table, 2 jet graphics move inside the circle. A display on Flight 52 also shows the circle and storm system.
Storm's been upgraded to tropical.
We're going to be up above the weather, but it's going to kick up a headwind that's going to slow us down.
Change course?
Well, you want to sit over here one of these days, what would you do?
90 minutes out of SFO and ahead of schedule, it won't affect our arrival time.
That's it?
And I would save on fuel and make for a much smoother ride for the passengers. I'd do it.
Well, geez, maybe I can retire. Make this flying computer to YouTube. Hang out with the grandkids, play a little golf.
Yeah, well, let's just hope you don't play golf with the grandkids, because the world can't afford to have that slice of yours passed
over. Very funny. Very amusing. It's a funny guy here, huh?
Oakland Pacific Global 52 requests permission to deviate for weather.
Roger, Pacific Global 52, deviate as needed.
That'll take us close to Intersection Hawes.
Yeah, it's a military operation zone.
Want me to plot an alternate course?
No, they'll stay on their side of the line, and we'll stay on ours.
Okay, commencing turn.
As the captain turns a knob, the state-of-the-art jetliner banks away from dark storm clouds. Now in first class, John works at his laptop. He lifts the China coffee cup, peers out his window, and takes a sip. Sharon approaches.
More coffee?
Oh, yes, please. Thank you.
His laptop shows a photo of him and Doug with snowboards.
Well, that looks like fun.
What? Oh. Just trying to keep up.
I know the feeling.
Sharon saunters off. John squints after her. As he adds cream to his coffee, he mockingly mouths his own words and makes a goofy face. His gaze settles on the image of him and Doug. John gazes thoughtfully, then reaches for a Pacific Global airphone. Now on an illuminated panel, the seatbelt indicator goes dark.
Folks, we've reached our cruising altitude of 65,000 feet and a speed just below the sound barrier. At this time, you're free to move about the cabin, or you can just sit back and enjoy the ride.
What do you think about changing the name of the restaurant?
Oh, yeah, so was I. So how about Mickey's Mind?
Our menu changes by the minute.
Very funny.
The stylish woman and her nervous brother follow the hip guy to the conference room. On Wake Island, two junior officers study the computer map.
Elements in position, Commander.
Contact the C-130. Launch target. Navy 559, this is home plate.
Roger, home plate. This is Navy 559 in position.
Launch target.
The Admiral listens intently. In the sky, the C-130 deploys the drone, which swoops upward. On Flight 52, John uses the airphone.
It's Doug. Leave a message at the beam.
Listen, I'm sorry I snapped at you. When I get home, we'll sit down, we'll talk man-to-man about the whole college thing, okay? All right? All right, I love you. Where are you? Study. Bye.
In the conference room.
Okay, the oysters will be harvested in Massachusetts at 6 a.m. and then touch down in Tokyo in time for dinner.
Beautiful. That's if they make their connection and if we can maintain a supply. If nothing slows us down.
Rachel, some cocktails?
Yeah, tell him to leave the cart.
What did I say?
Amazing.
Now on Wake Island.
The drone is transmitting and is accelerating to Mach 2.
Contact Navy 347 and confirm. Navy 347, this is home plate.
Do you have target acquisition?
In the airborne F-18, the pilot sights a target on his display.
Affirmative, home plate. 347 is preliminary target acquisition.
Back on Flight 52.
Mr. Stein?
Excuse me, are you the head stewardess?
Flight attendant, Dad.
I've been called worse. I've been instructed to take you below.
That sounds ominous.
Maybe you should take a couple of those. Chill out.
I'm chill, you know. Just enough. Mm-hmm. At least Carter and Kennedy will be happy to see me. We should get moving. It says here every 2 hours, and it's been almost three.
They're fine. They've got each other to keep them company.
You're right. They're fine. I know they're fine.
Oh, this way.
Oh, sorry.
They'll be fine once we land.
I'll take care of them.
As Sharon follows Mr. Stein, the blonde teenager gets her attention.
Oh, is there another restaurant?
There's one in the back of this section.
Right in here.
Sharon shows Mr. Stein into a small elevator. The teenager heads to the rear of the plane. In the cockpit, the captain squints, seeing a small object in the distance.
Carl, hand me my binoculars.
The captain lifts the lenses to his eyes, making out the drone's form above the clouds. Carl frowns.
What is that?
Probably some military jock doing some high-altitude maneuvers or something.
did deviate pretty far south.
Close to the military zone, but we're still outside its perimeter.
No, lost visual.
What do you think?
That's pretty far off our starboard. Carl, make your way back to the galley window. See if you can spot it.
Carl gets up.
Go easy back there. We don't want to alarm anybody.
As Carl heads into first class, the cockpit door fails to latch shut behind him. Now David uses the binoculars.
If it comes any closer, we'll turn. I'm going to get the folks back in their seats. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain speaking.
We may encounter a little turbulence, so I'm going to put the seatbelt sign back on and ask that you return to your seats and buckle up. Thanks.
The Stein girls read a magazine.
Why would anybody wear that? And you know who she's dating.
Oh, I know.
Now as John gains access to a lavatory, Carl passes by.
Excuse me.
The navigator smiles politely, then peers through a round emergency exit window in a small galley. Now, outside, the jetliner streams over an expanse of cloud cover. On Wake Island, the admiral faces the commander, who nods to a lieutenant.
Navy 347, confirmed. Good target resolution.
The admiral paces.
Complete, Navy 347, as targeting good resolution. Distance is 480 miles, over.
Foxtrot Alpha Whiskey, fire at will.
Navy 347, this is home plate. Foxtrot Alpha Whiskey, fire at will.
On the F-18, the titanium-headed missile rides under the jet's wing. In the cockpit, the pilot grips the control stick, his thumb beside a red button. As he studies his targeting display, a second object appears. The pilot squints and tweaks a knob. On Wake Island, the commander nods again to the lieutenant.
Repeat, Navy 347, Foxtrot, Alpha, Whiskey.
The fighter pilot's display shows one target.
Roger, home plate. Fire one.
He hits a trigger. The missile rockets forward. On Flight 52, Sharon and Mr. Stein find the kennel dogs in a cargo hold.
There they are. Watch your head.
Thanks. Hello, guys. Hello there, huh? Did you miss me? Hey, did you miss me?
Oh. Do you travel with them often?
Nope. This is the first time. It was all part of a deal I made with the girls. If I took the transfer, then the entire family would move to Tokyo for the year. Right, guys? Where we go? Where we go?
Sharon steps over to a service phone on the wall.
Sharon here?
Hey, we're getting people back to their seats now.
We'll be right up.
She hangs up. Now the unarmed missile rockets forward. In the F-18, the pilot's gaze fixes on the targeting display, where the second object is again visible.
Home plate, this is Navy 347. Confirmed that only one target drone was dropped.
The admiral glances to the commander, who nods again to the lieutenant.
Navy 347, this is home plate. Confirmed, only one target drone dropped.
Home plate, I read two targets.
Two junior officers on Wake Island listen warily. Under the admiral's glare, the commander eyes the map table. In airspace, the missile streams forward and the jetliner flies steadily. On the jetliner, the male flight attendant collects spent cocktail glasses from the conference room.
Turbulence shouldn't last long, then we'll open up the room again.
Okay, just
one more minute.
Is it a fighter?
David checks the unidentified aircraft with binoculars.
No. No, that's a military target drone.
The captain buckles his seatbelt. Behind him, the cockpit door hangs open. David buckles up, too. Outside, the missile rockets toward the passenger jet. It pierces the port side. The missile needles through a beverage cart in the aisle, uproots a pair of seats, and tears a gaping hole in the other side of the cabin as it exits the plane. Passengers wince in the violent wind, and a flight attendant gets sucked down the aisle. In the cockpit, David pulls on an oxygen mask. In first class, now a whirl with debris, Carl clambers to his feet. As John braces himself in the lavatory, the Stein girls hold on in the main cabin. The girls' seats are right beside one of the breech holes. In the conference room, the four occupants scramble for oxygen masks, and the blonde teenager jostles in a second lavatory. Now, John struggles to close his lavatory door. As he fights the depressurizing air, he glimpses Carl in first class, then inches the door shut. He locks it. In the cockpit, a gust rips the oxygen mask from David's hands. As Carl gropes his way toward the cockpit, the captain loses his grip on his own oxygen mask. David hands him a mini first aid style oxygen tank. Carl gets sucked away from the cockpit. A belted-in passenger loses her grip on the navigator. He claws at the carpeting as he's sucked down the aisle. Now the Stein girls briefly hold hands. One sister grips the seatbelt, but the suction draws her halfway out the hole. Their mother manages to grab the other girl's hands. In first class, Carl slides helplessly down the aisle. In the breached cabin, Mrs. Stein clings to one daughter. Carl skitters down the stairs toward the main cabin. As he grips the railing, his legs flap horizontally in the air. Below, Mr. Stein and Sharon stumble out of the cargo hold into a storage junction. Above, Mrs. Stein still holds onto one daughter, whose entire body hovers horizontally. The other sister loses her grip on the seatbelt and disappears. The suction tugs the other girl from her mother's hands, and she flies out the hole. Mrs. Stein shrieks, her hands reaching desperately. Now, the blonde teenager trapped in the lavatory panics. As anguished passengers thrash, one couple's seat tears free of the floor. Two men tumble out of the aircraft. Below, Sharon and Mr. Stein try the small service elevator. Now wires short circuit under the loosening seat. As the service elevator stops halfway between two levels, the uprooted double seat bucks and tips back against an empty pair of seats. In the cockpit, David uses a radio handset.
Global 52, come in! Hold the center, come in, please!
As Sharon and Mr. Stein jostle in the service elevator, gasping passengers go limp in their seats.
I'm gonna release the autopilot! Try to take this thing down manually! Deploy the spoilers!
Spoilers deployed!
All right!
David gets a breath from the mini tank. In the breached cabin, Carl weakens, lets go of the stair rail, and slides down the aisle. As a horrified old man gapes, Carl's eyes widen at the breech hold. Passengers reach out for him, but he tumbles to the edge. His hands grab at a torn seat back, but he rolls out of sight. Back in the cockpit. As David turns a knob, a digital readout decreases from 57,000. David sets it at 11,000. Dark conference room, the hip guy gets thrown across the table. The blonde teenager pushes against the lavatory walls. In the other lavatory, John grimaces.
Current altitude!
One level 570! Descending at 12,000 feet per minute!
Make sure the air packs are on full everywhere!
Air packs on!
Two adjustable nozzles over John's head activate. He notices them and opens them fully. Back in the cockpit. The captain breathes from the mini tank.
I dropped the flaps, so sheer off. Keep your finger on the autopilot.
David obeys, reaching for the button.
Lock it in. Breathe
out. Captain! Captain!
The captain passes out. In the lavatory, John braces himself. Water surges out of the sink. In the cockpit, David engages the autopilot. His eyes droop shut and he slouches. Sharon and Mr. Stein, still conscious in the service elevator, wobble anxiously. The passengers in the breached cabin fall unconscious. Several hold their throats. Mrs. Stein's hand flutters beside her cheek, and her distressed gaze stays blankly fixed on the hole in the plane. In the cockpit, computer displays remain active behind the disabled pilots. Mickey and Rachel hold hands across the conference room table as they and the male flight attendant all breathe into oxygen masks. Sharon pounds on the dead elevator's door. In the lavatory, John nearly doubles over and rubs his face. Now, on Wake Island, a petty officer carries a tray of bottled water past the command center. A junior officer studies a laptop, then interjects as the commander chats with the admiral.
Sir, something is strange here. The drone target signal is still active, but the missile is no longer transmitting.
The commander presses a microphone's talk button.
Navy 347, this is home plate. We are receiving conflicting signals.
Our monitors verify missile impact. However, target drone is still transmitting. Do you copy?
Confirm missile impact. Tracking target drone in vertical fall since impact.
It is descending at a rate of
12,000 feet per minute.
The two junior officers watch the Admiral.
The missile may have just grazed the drone. Without a warhead, it would take a full-face hit to destroy it.
But 12,000 feet per minute is too slow.
Well, the impact may have distorted the drone's shape, increasing the drag, slowing its descent.
Home plate, this is Navy 347.
Vertical scan indicates the target's descent rate has decreased.
10,000 feet per minute.
The commander hooks an eyebrow. On Flight 52, Don and the other few conscious people on board jostle about.
8,000 feet per minute. 6,000.
Target leveling out at 11,000 feet.
347, proceed toward target immediately.
Roger, home plate. I'm 460 miles out. ETA is 16 minutes.
The F-18 banks away in the sky. On Wake Island, the Admiral eyeballs the commander. The younger officer tightens his lips and strides to a window overlooking the busy outer office. He anxiously rubs his nose. The Admiral frowns to himself, then joins the commander at the window.
There is only one explanation for recovery from a rapid descent like that.
I'm aware of that, Admiral.
On the damaged jetliner, light wind ruffles an unconscious woman's long hair. All along the aisle, seats remain occupied by motionless passengers. Toward the rear of the cabin, debris blocks the conference room door. Inside, Rachel, Mickey, and the flight attendant keep breathing through oxygen masks. Mickey takes his off.
We got air.
Three TV monitors around them lend a dim glow to the room. The flight attendant tries a service phone.
Where's Tech?
Rachel finds their third partner lying still on the floor, his lifeless eyes open. In the lavatory, John scans the cramped space amid flickering lights. Meanwhile, the F-18 comes upon the jetliner, flying high above it. In the one-man cockpit, the pilot's eyes fix on the sight before him. He unstraps his oxygen mask, revealing a slack-jawed expression. The jetliner flies steadily off his starboard side.
Home plate, Navy 347 has visual contact.
The pilot stares.
We hit a commercial airliner.
On Wake Island, the commander leans toward his mic.
Confirm last transmission.
Confirm contact with a commercial transport.
The Admiral covers his face.
There's a 3-foot hole on its starboard side and a 6-foot one in the port fuselage.
Are we operating outside our hot zone?
I don't know, sir. It's close.
Is it possible the missile locked onto something outside the zone?
It's possible, sir, if they were close enough to the perimeter and had a big enough heat signature.
What would be flying that high?
347, can you identify aircraft?
Home plate, it's a Pacific Global Stratton.
It's a new SST they're running out of San Francisco.
The Admiral shifts his jaw as sweat beads on his forehead. The officers watch him.
Why weren't we told about this?
We were, sir. They must be flying outside their normal corridor.
The commander leans to the mic.
347, are there any signs of life on board?
In the F-18, the pilot squints through his canopy at the damaged aircraft. The slender jetliner dwarfs the fighter jet.
No apparent movement in the cabin or the cockpit. I'm less than 30 feet away.
347, drop back to a safe distance and monitor from there. That aircraft is unstable. Copy?
The Admiral removes his jacket.
Roger, home plate.
Above the jetliner, the F-18 drops back behind it. On Wake Island, the commander nods to the junior officers.
Go.
As they leave, the Admiral leans on the computerized map table and eyes the commander soberly. On Flight 52, John forces the lavatory door open. Winds buffet his graying hair as he stumbles out. As the overhead lights flicker, he heads through first class. Feathery bits of debris float through the cabin. He sees the unconscious passengers jostling in their seats and spots the open cockpit door. He bursts in, finding both pilots slumped in their chairs. Blood trickles from the pilot's ear. John shakes the co-pilot.
Hey!
He feels David's neck, then crouches down between the unconscious men. Gaping toward the window, John takes the pilot's wrist and checks for his pulse. John staggers out of the cockpit into first class and jogs down the aisle. He squeezes between two passengers whose heads hang limply to their sides. Shuffling down the stairs to the main cabin, he stares out at wisps of clouds and small bits of debris passing between the two gaping holes.
Oh my God. Hello? Ah! Ah!
The teenager pounds on the lavatory door. As John advances, Sharon sees him through the elevator's window beside his feet.
Oh, I can hear you! Ah!
John looks over his shoulder, then sets his jaw. Ducking low, he passes between the two openings and continues on.
Help!
No!
I'm coming!
Get down to the door!
Make sure it's unlocked!
He strains against the door.
Hang on!
John searches through the galley.
Please
don't go away! Wait a second, I won't leave you!
John searches the cabin and finds a long piece of metal.
Okay, hang on.
Okay. He wedges the flat end into the door jamb and wiggles the handle.
Push it out!
The door springs open. The girl stumbles out into his arms and John checks her face. The wind blows her straight blonde hair as she gapes around the cabin. She faces John.
Are they all dead?
No.
Yes, they are. You're lying. They're not moving.
Listen to me. They're unconscious, okay? From the decompression, all right? They're all unconscious. Now let me try and get us some help. I'm gonna need to find a crew member.
Wait. I think I saw a crew member going in an elevator.
Where?
There.
She points back up the aisle. John holds her close as they make their way toward the holes.
Okay.
They crouch low.
Get low, okay? Go!
They hurry past the damaged section to the elevator. Sharon looks through the glass near John's feet.
Hello?
Teenager sits on the stairs and buries her face in her hands. John tugs on the top of the elevator door and it pops open.
Okay. Are you okay?
Yes.
He helps Sharon out of the half-raised elevator, then reaches for Mr. Stein.
Okay, sir?
Yeah.
Okay.
As John helps him out, Sharon surveys the damaged cabin.
What happened?
I don't know exactly.
I felt something
climb
into the plane, and then we went into a
free fall. Go hold to the side of the plane. Oh, my God.
No, don't.
Stein rushes up the aisle.
Be careful.
As he crouches by his unconscious wife, the teenager weeps on the stairs.
I have to get to the cockpit.
Wait. The captain's dead. We're on autopilot.
We have to radio for help.
As John looks back, Sharon leans over the teenager.
Sir! Are you okay?
Drop yourself in!
They head upstairs, leaving Mr. Stein behind. In the conference room, the male flight attendant beats on the door.
Hello!
Rachel sits clutching Tack's jacket. Hunched over the table, Mickey rubs his forehead. Our view pulls away from the blocked door and down the aisle.
Hello!
Lights flicker above the unconscious passengers. Now, on Wake Island, a junior officer wearing a headset strides to the command center. He enters and whispers to the commander. The commander nods, then steps close to the admiral. The visitor's glazed eyes shift from the window to the younger officer.
There's been no mayday on either international emergency channel.
Maybe their radio's down.
Anyone who survived the impact would have been subjected to complete decompression, sir. There's less than 1% oxygen in subspace, and no one is surviving on that.
How do you account for the planes leveling off?
Maybe in the chaos, someone had the sense to re-engage the autopilot. Matos reported them slumped over the console, sir.
So you're assuming everyone is dead?
It's an unfortunate probability, sir, but yes. I believe they're all dead.
As his superior turns his head away, the commander leaves. The admiral gazes out the window and shakes his head slightly. Now the jetliner speeds over clouds. Sharon enters the cockpit.
David!
She shakes the co-pilot's shoulders and cups his chin.
Can you hear me, David?
What's our flight number?
52.
John lifts the radio handset.
David.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global, flight 52. Do you copy?
Are you a pilot?
Twin engines. Nothing like this. Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global, flight 52. Do you copy?
Now a bald man watches a board displaying flight information.
Carson?
Yeah, Jack.
You got 52 to Tokyo?
Hang on. Yeah.
They're overdue with their position report.
Yeah, you're right. No update since Haas. You want me to send a request?
Give them till 14:30.
Back on flight 52.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global, flight 52. Do you read me?
John shoots an exasperated look to Sharon in first class. The dead pilot sits slumped in a seat.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global, flight 52. Do you read me?
Sharon drapes a blanket over his face and checks the co-pilot in another seat.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global, flight 52. Does anyone copy? Sharon! Sharon, I need your help in here.
What about me?
Stay with the co-pilot. If he wakes up and starts talking at all, come and get one of us.
The teenager stops Sharon.
I can't do that. I'm not even supposed to be here. I mean, my dad was supposed to visit me, and then my mom said that I had to go to Japan and see him. It's all just a big mistake.
You're right. You're right. But we can't change that. Right now, we have to look after each other, okay? You can do this.
What if he dies?
He won't die. You just stay with him, keep him company. His name is David. I'll be back to check on you in a bit. You'll be fine.
As the teenager paces nervously beside the unconscious co-pilot, Sharon joins John in the cockpit.
Anything yet?
Does anyone copy? Nothing. If we were transmitting, someone would have responded by now.
He scans the instrument panels.
You know this cockpit? Anything look familiar in here?
You're the pilot.
My Skymaster has all dials and gates. This is a glass cockpit. All the instrumentation is here. I just don't know where. And we need to make contact with someone who does. That's our first priority.
Okay.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Pacific Global Flight 52. Anyone copy?
Outside, the F-18 trails the jet. Now on Wake Island.
There's been nothing broadcast on any frequency.
Keep on it.
Yes, sir.
The commander paces to the admiral's spot by the window.
Nothing, sir.
It won't be long before Oakland Center realizes that they've lost contact with the Stratton.
We have containment for now. I'm proposing we classify the aircraft as a derelict ship and act upon it accordingly.
Scuttling an abandoned trawler is a long way from downing a commercial airliner.
Perhaps, sir, but these are the facts as we know them right now. There's no physiological way that anybody would have survived explosive decompression. That aircraft is on autopilot, and it will, if left unabated, eventually fly back over land, run out of fuel, and then drop to the ground.
We've already made one mistake today. I would caution against acting too hastily.
I believe not acting would be our second mistake, sir.
The admiral glances back at the junior officers, then leans to the commander.
If the hull of that aircraft were ever found, the facts would make themselves known.
He levels a steely gaze on the younger officer.
Valentine, get me the oceanic depth charts for the area.
Yes, sir.
The senior officers return to the map table. On the Stratton, Sharon takes an aerophone from one of the seats and tries its buttons. The teenager watches beside her.
Won't it work?
No power.
Oh.
The girl pulls out her cell phone.
Mine works.
We're 1,500 miles from the closest cell tower. We'd have to be just off the coast to get any reception.
What about the radio?
It's not transmitting. We probably lost connection with the antenna.
So, we're alone up here?
For now.
Sharon gives her a weak smile and walks away. Downstairs, our view centers on the fallen baggage in front of the conference room door.
Hello?
In the dim light of the monitors, Mickey backs away from the door. As the overhead lights barely flicker on Rachel's resigned face, the attendant resumes beating on the wall.
Hello?
There isn't nobody out there.
No. Hey, sis, listen to me.
If there was anybody out there, they would have heard us by now.
I'm the pessimist in the family, right? And I know we are going to be okay. Hey, listen, listen. You hear? We're still flying.
That's because they're all dead, Mickey. And so are we.
Now, at Oakland Center, the controller uses a phone.
Pacific Global, this is Oakland Center. Flight 52's position report is overdue. Are you in contact with them?
We'll look into it. Jack, Oakland Center lost contact with 52.
Try the data link. Find out what's going on.
Carson strides away through the Pacific Global offices, now in the Stratton cockpit.
Hey, Sharon? Do you have any idea what that is?
She kneels between the pilot seats.
It's a data link. Why didn't I think of that?
What?
Flight 52, what's your status? It's Pacific Global.
In San Francisco?
No, no, there's a terminal in the dispatch office. We can text message back and forth.
Woo! Are you kidding me? Tell them what's going on. Tell them what's going on.
Emergency mayday.
Aircraft damage.
Aircraft damage.
Radio dead. Mid-Pacific. Need help.
At Pacific Global, Carson gapes at the message. He quickly types back. Words type out on the aircraft's monitor.
Flight 52.
Woo!
Call received. Stand by on this channel.
Meanwhile, Carson prints out the emergency message. He rips it off the printer, looks it over again, then rushes out of the data link room. Later in the cockpit.
Flight 52, explain nature of emergency. Nature assistance. Amount of fuel, present position. Okay. Tell them pilot dead. Co-pilot unconscious. Navigator lost. Tell them I am a weekend pilot.
Two holes in cab. Suspect bomb. Complete decompression. Three passengers. One flight attendant survived. Others dead or comatose. Need help. That's an understatement. Yeah, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, we got a plane in distress. Flight 52 to Tokyo.
It's strapped.
How bad is it?
Explosive decompression. Flight crew dead. We made contact with the flight attendant, weekend pilot. They and two others were in positive pressure areas during decompression.
Was it a bomb?
Could well be. We're gathering as much information as we can.
Can this pilot handle a Stratton?
I don't know. I'm going to try taking you through a turn.
Well, if you think you can handle it, then do it. I'll be there in 20 minutes.
Bye.
The young executive closes his phone as he descends in a glass elevator. Jack returns to the crowded data link room.
Okay, people, listen up. I need detailed charts of Flight 52's last known position, fuel estimates, and contingency plans. On the job. Let's go.
As the employees leave, Jack and Carson stay behind. The supervisor lets out a breath. On Wake Island.
Nichols, what is their current position?
They're about to fly over the Nelson Abyssal.
The map table displays the blinking plane's path.
It's over 2 miles deep.
The Admiral's jaw tenses.
It's been 55 minutes since the Phoenix struck the Stratton. There's been no change in course or speed. Our course of action seems very clear.
The three khaki-uniformed junior officers nod and leave the table. The commander follows the Admiral to a corner of the windowed room.
If she remains aloft, we risk further loss of life, not to mention the damage that this incident could inflict upon the Navy and upon our country. Washington authorized this test because we don't want to fight even. We want to fight ahead. And as unfortunate as this situation may be, if it surfaces, it could cost us that advantage, sir.
I may not agree with your assessment of the situation, but this is your command. Given what we know, I won't stand in your way.
Understood, sir. Get me Navy 347.
Navy 347, stand by.
Home plate, this is Navy 347.
Standing by.
The fighter pilot waits. The Admiral turns his glossy-eyed stare away as the commander leans toward the mic.
Navy 347, this is home plate. You are to render the autopilot on the Stratton inoperable. Confirm?
In the F-18, the pilot shakes his head uncertainly.
Confirm, Navy 347.
His eyes shift. In the command center, the Admiral rejoins the commander and junior officers at the map table. He stares ahead soberly. In the F-18, the pilot lowers his gaze and fastens his mask.
Roger, home plate.
Navy 347 proceeding with mission profile.
At Pacific Global, Carson brings Jack a map.
Jack, based on their current location and fuel port, if you're going to turn them back, you have to do it right now.
See what our weekend pilot can do.
Jack types the data link.
Can you identify and use autopilot heading knob?
John spots the knob and unbuttons his cuffs.
Tell them yes.
He sits in the pilot seat. Meanwhile, the F-18 drops behind the airliner. Sharon reads the next message as Jack types it.
Can you recover if you lose control or autopilot fails?
John shakes his head as he rolls up his sleeves.
I doubt it. But tell him to give me the coordinates and let's try this.
Request new coordinates, ready to attempt turn.
The fighter targets the Stratton.
Magnetic heading?
80 degrees.
Okay, ready?
Uh-huh.
John turns the knob.
Home plate, I have this lock.
A red target flashes with the airliner at its center. In the air, the F-18 pilot curls his finger around the trigger. The targeting sight drifts off the Stratton.
Home plate, the Stratton is turning.
Repeat, the Stratton is turning.
The officers gather at the map table.
Heading north.
Still turning.
Airspeed and altitude unchanged.
The Admiral grins.
New course is 80 degrees.
On the Stratton, John leans back in the pilot seat, smiling.
You did it!
Sharon giddily bounces and grips his hand.
Okay.
We're headed home!
The teenager watches the data link.
All right, we still gotta land this beast.
Very nice work. Everyone here is working hard to bring you home. Stand by.
As the fighter jet trails the Stratton, the Wake Island map table shows the jetliner's projected course.
He's heading back to California.
A 347, break off and stay in trail formation.
Oh, Blake, do you require a visual of the cockpit?
Negative, 347, stay in trail. Aircraft is still considered unstable.
Roger, I read, stay in trail.
Nothing has changed.
No, everything has changed.
As the Admiral points happily at the map, the commander swaps curt looks with his staff. Now, in Johnson's car.
He made the turn.
Without a hitch.
All right, be ready to brief me in 5 minutes.
The young executive dials his cell. In a high-rise, a short blonde wearing a skirt suit answers. Words appear. Beneficial insurance.
Betts here.
It's Wayne Johnson. We have a situation. It's a Stratton.
Back on Flight 52, Sharon faces the teenager.
Let's find some room.
No, Sharon, I need you to stay here with me. Can you get it by yourself?
Oh, yeah.
It's in the galley on the left side.
Okay.
The teenager steps hesitantly out of the cockpit. She walks slowly past the unconscious first-class passengers. Slight turbulence jostles them, moving their heads from side to side. In the cockpit, Sharon looks down the aisle.
Tough kid.
Yeah. They're all tougher than you think.
She plops down in the co-pilot seat next to John.
You have any?
Me? Oh, no. Haven't found the right guy. Or the time.
Their smiles fade slightly as they face the windows.
There's never enough time for them. You just try to do the best you can, not screw them up in the process.
Be close with your boy?
Yeah. His mother died when he was four, so it's just been us.
Sharon looks away.
Then one day, you know, you wake up and...
and they've got minds of their own.
Yeah. You got that right. I gotta learn to back off a little.
I'm sure you do just fine.
John's ice blue eyes shift from a long stare and he leans down to the data link.
Come on, talk to us.
You are listening to video description on the SAP channel. To return to regular program audio, turn off the SAP feature on your TV or VCR. Now the teenager reaches into the galley. Scattered food and debris cover the floor and counter. She picks up a leaky water bottle and quickly drops it. Shaking off her hand, she picks through the remains on the floor. With the breeze tousling her blonde hair, she glances back toward the cockpit, then heads downstairs. In the main cabin, wind rushes between the two jagged holes. The teen inches cautiously ahead, gripping the red leather seats. Mr. Stein remains huddled at his wife's side.
You should come upstairs. It's a lot safer.
Amy and Erica want to be closer to the movie screen. My wife and I changed seats with them. All the planning for the future. Worrying when girls become homeless.
The teen moves carefully through the wind and kneels before Mr. Stein. He rubs his wife's hand, staring at it.
My whole life was right here.
Look, we're on our way back to San Francisco, and there are people on the ground that are helping us.
He lifts his tearful eyes briefly.
But we're gonna make it. So you should come upstairs.
Now, at Pacific Global, Mr. Johnson prints out a copy of the Mayday data link message. He paces in the room full of employees, reading it. His brow furrows as he sifts through the pages, then looks to Jack.
How many planes do we have in the air?
18.
Let's make sure they're all right.
Carson answers a phone.
Listen, folks, if you're not directly involved with getting 52 back, please return to your desk. We need to keep this quiet until we have a clear plan of action, all right? Thank you.
Oakland Center's on line 6.
I'll take that.
He passes Johnson the receiver.
This is Wayne Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, this is Marlene Cobb, Oakland Center. What is the status of Pacific Global 52?
We're in contact. There's a radio problem and communication is currently limited to the data link. They're headed back. I'll call back with specifics once we have them.
All right, sir. We'll continue monitoring and await your call. Thank you, sir.
A split screen shows them lower their phones. Johnson looks to Carson.
Would you give us a minute, please?
As he leaves the glass-walled room, Jack steps over to the executive.
We've got about an hour until the world starts breathing down our necks. I want these men thinking about that aircraft, not fielding calls from the press or being badgered by some outside agency. So, what's next? Can this guy bring it home?
He's a weekend pilot, but with some luck, he's got a chance.
Met stands behind them.
He says he's got passengers alive, but in some sort of coma. Is that even possible?
It's not only possible, it's unavoidable. Oxygen deprivation at 65,000 feet. They had no chance.
Who are you? This is Ann Metz from Beneficial Insurance. Would you excuse us, please?
Sure.
As Jack leaves, Johnson shows Metz the data link pages.
This is what we're dealing with.
Back on the Stratton, Mr. Stein props his wife on her feet. The teenager clutches one of the seats, watching. A bolt on its base pulls free. The teen jumps back as the two seats containing passengers get sucked out the hole. The teen turns away, open-mouthed. Grimacing, she looks back to the Steins.
We're staying here!
Now in the F-18.
Home plate, this is Navy 347.
Navy 347, go for home plate.
Home plate, we have passengers and debris falling from the plane.
As the Wake Island staff trades glances, the commander leans to the mic.
347, keep your distance.
Roger, home plate, falling back.
The fighter jet eases behind the damaged airliner. Now on the Stratton, Mr. Stein buckles his wife back into her seat. He squeezes past her and sits in the seat between her and the window.
I'm not leaving my wife.
The teenager stumbles backwards toward the stairwell. As he takes his seat, she hurries back up. Light bits of trash swirl freely around the cabin. Draping his arm around his wife, Mr. Stein places his cheek against her forehead, then kisses it. Bright light shines in from the windows beside him.
Instructions on landing. I'm gonna have to talk him down over a damn typewriter.
In the data link room, Johnson types, working on solution.
How is it that this works and not the radio?
That link runs off a satellite, not an exposed radio antenna.
So no one else can monitor your communications?
No.
No, dead ends on both sides.
So many will die.
We have a chance here.
It'll get worse, not better. And it'll be left on your doorstep.
Met spots Jack approaching. He enters, holding out a seating chart.
Passenger manifest. Should we have BR contact relatives of the passengers, we can start booking them on flights to San Francisco.
No, not just yet. I still owe Oakland Center a call, and I want to make sure we're not missing anything before we go public.
All right.
As Jack strides away, the two executives watch him warily through the glass. Johnson slides the data link room door shut and retakes his seat at the screen.
What's in your mind?
There's a finite amount of water in the well.
What?
Follow me on this. You have an amateur pilot flying the most sophisticated aircraft in the world. There are three scenarios here. One, your weekend pilot crashes into the ocean and everyone on board is killed. 102 death payouts is a figure that I can calculate.
I'm sure you can.
I deal in actuarial tables, and loss of life does, in fact, have a fixed price attached to it.
Go on.
Scenario number two, Mr. Barry.
She chops her hand onto a map.
Slams that plane directly into the heart of downtown San Francisco. Thousands will be killed.
And that doesn't concern you much.
If he destroys 10 city blocks, federal disaster relief will probably kick in.
And you'd be off the hook. Oh,
possibly. And outcome number three. If he successfully lands that plane, we are all in an unenviable position. The death payout is one thing, but that man is carrying a plane full of patients, likely requiring around-the-clock care for the rest of their diminished existence. Billions of dollars in lawsuits, victims' families, pain and suffering. The bills will be endless. Beneficial insurance will be bankrupt, and then the victims will go after your airline.
You guys always figure out a way to pay.
Johnson gets up.
Not this time. The numbers are too big. Pacific Global will fold under the weight of Stratton. There is no upside to landing that plane.
There are people alive up there.
Marginally.
The executive glares at Metz. Then slams a Stratton flight manual down. He takes a seat at the desk and opens it. Johnson flips through the pages, then turns back to her.
I still think he has a chance.
Now, in the cockpit.
Our fuel's low.
Well, how could that be possible? We're supposed to be going all the way to Tokyo.
The fuel load would have been calculated through the thin air at 60,000 feet. Down here, we're probably burning at three times that rate. I don't know if we have enough fuel to make it all the way back.
The teenager eyes the cabin.
What's gonna happen to them? Are they gonna stay like that?
John looks back.
I don't know, but they're gonna need help as soon as possible.
Meanwhile, at Pacific Global.
You could include others in the decision process, but that would take time.
Do you think the board would vote on something like this?
How many thousands of families will be ruined when Pacific Global folds? I mean, think of all the people on the ground whose lives will be destroyed by some insane gamble to try to land that plane. I mean, you can't even talk to the guy. He's over the Pacific heading towards a storm. And very soon, the decision will be out of your hands.
Jack approaches.
Something center on six. They want an update.
Johnson clenches his fist and looks to Metz. Rising from the desk, he picks up the phone.
This is Wayne Johnson. We've lost contact with Flight 52, initiating search and rescue.
That happened.
Jack checks the data link screen. On Wake Island, the Admiral and Commander watch the map table. Nichols enters.
Pacific Global is reporting the loss of Flight 52. Search and rescue are en route.
We've lost containment.
No. The window is just tightening. All right, if they find this aircraft, this is going to be the beginning of a very lengthy and damaging investigation that the Navy does not need.
The Nimitz is the closest carrier.
Then launch a search and rescue now.
75 minutes is the earliest intercept.
We are ending this right now.
The Admiral furrows his brow. Now, the F-18 follows the Stratton.
Homeplate, this is Navy 347. Confirm current mission.
Navy 347, this is Homeplate. Confirm current mission. This aircraft is deemed derelict.
The pilot shifts his jaw.
Confirmed.
Back at the command center, the junior officers and admiral stare at the mission commander. He swallows and presses his lips together. Behind the Stratton, the F-18 banks to the left.
Homeplate, this is 347, requesting permission to abort current mission.
Negative 347, proceed as ordered. Confirm, proceed as ordered.
Sweat beads on the pilot's face.
Negative, Homeplate. Navy 347 cannot follow that order at this time.
347, you are in violation of a direct order. Consider the consequences.
Navy 347 has, sir.
347, that is a derelict ship. Do you understand?
No, sir. It's a ship in distress.
He knows he can't be court-martialed for refusing an order you have no authority giving. That boy isn't killing anybody else today, and neither are we. 347, this is Admiral Hennings. Report to the Nimitz. Current mission is aborted. Repeat, current mission is aborted.
The pilot grins.
Roger, Homeplate. Navy 347 en route to Nimitz.
The admiral looks sternly at the officers and mission commander. In the sky, the fighter pilot gazes at the Stratton. With a grin, he banks the F-18 away. On Wake Island.
Admiral, this is my command. I will put more aircraft in the air.
No, you won't. You're going to wait until Matos lands on the Nimitz to see if he keeps his mouth shut.
There's no guarantee that the Stratton will even make it back to San Francisco. Our problems could just disappear into the ocean.
Maybe. That's no longer your decision.
As the Admiral steps away, Valentine lowers her gaze. The commander turns his head from his junior officers. The Admiral faces him again.
Now you can tell whatever story suits you best, but my report to the Pentagon will be as it happened.
The mission commander swallows and his eyes shift. The Admiral glares at him, then picks up his coat and briefcase. He looks back fiercely and heads out. As the officers stand motionless, the mission commander stares after him. Now at Pacific Global, Johnson walks through the office with Jack.
I need two copies of the data link printouts, one to be forwarded to air traffic control, the other for corporate. I'm assembling all the available senior West Coast executives.
Well, I can monitor the data link while you brief corporate.
No, listen, I need you to make those copies while I try to make contact. If there's anyone left to make contact with.
I just don't understand. There's no way the satellite failed, or we'd be hearing about it from our other aircraft. And if the data link was working before, then it should be.
Yeah, it should be, but it's not, which is why I initiated search and rescue. Or would you feel better if we kept pinging away in there and let whatever survivors drown while we try to work out the bug in our system?
Right, right.
Johnson stares at Jack sternly.
ATC is waiting for those printouts.
Jack shifts his eyes, then walks away from his boss. Johnson watches him go and drops his gaze. With his hands in his pockets, the executive walks down a hallway and enters the glass-walled data link room. Inside, Metz shuffles some paperwork. Johnson slides the door closed.
Keeping everyone busy?
Keeping their minds on their work.
And outside this room while you create a paper trail.
Johnson eyes the data link screen.
Working on a solution. Now, that was our last successful communication with 52. Then I scrambled search and rescue. It's all by the book.
I'm assuming you have a plan.
Yeah. What not to do in the cockpit of the world's most advanced plane.
Now the Stratton flies through storm clouds. John and Sharon stare out the windows.
Have you ever flown through anything like this?
My little Skymaster? We'd be turning around looking for the nearest airport to set down in.
No airport to turn back to here.
Nope. You can't fly over it, and it could be hundreds of miles long.
Well, what about if you left it on autopilot?
If the turbulence is too great, it could disengage the autopilot, then I'd have to take the controls.
Taking a seat, Sharon looks back at the teenager.
I'll take that chance.
Yeah. John faces the controls.
All right. Let's see if they have any advice.
John types, request instructions on navigating storm. The message appears on Johnson's screen.
Are you ready?
I don't think anyone's ever ready for something like this.
With the manual by his side, the executive starts to type. In the cockpit, Sharon reads the incoming message.
Heavy turbulence expected as you pass through the storm. It's very important that you alter the center of gravity by transferring fuel between tanks.
John furrows his brow.
By what?
Does that sound wrong?
Well, if I knew where the tanks were.
He studies the cockpit and the panels above his head. Back at Pacific Global, Jack approaches the data link room. Johnson gets up.
Yeah, still no luck.
You look like you used a brake.
Thanks. But I need you out there making sure other planes are in the air.
What's with the manual?
There's going to be a press conference later, and I just want to be on top of all the details. Listen, speaking of which, I need a report on everything that happened today. A roster of everyone on duty, step-by-step action taken by your staff, as well as your own thought process behind any and all actions taken. Now? Jack, you were the senior man on duty today. FAA and NTSB will want to know what you did and when you did it. Now, I'm already starting to compile my own timeline of events. I suggest you get to yours while it's still fresh in your mind.
Timeline. Right.
Jack walks away from his boss. The executive watches him, then turns back to the data link. Jack heads over to Carson's desk.
What's going on?
How much do you like your job?
Carson studies his supervisor's serious face.
What do you need me to do?
Jack motions for him to follow. Carson gets up, then looks around cautiously. Meanwhile, Johnson sits at the data link.
Why can't you just go down on your own?
As he types, Sharon reads his message in the cockpit.
In the center of the overhead CRT screen are four touchpads designated low-pressure fuel valve position.
We got him. Got it. Yeah.
Switch them to the off position.
Off?
That's what it says.
All of them?
John checks the screen and looks up at the switches. He shakes his head.
Let's just try one and see what happens.
He presses a button.
They want acknowledgement.
Yeah, and I want to make sure that I don't screw this up.
John reaches above and presses the remaining three. The lit keys go dark. As the plane continues to shake, he checks the screens and raises his brow. Sharon and the teenager watch anxiously.
Is that all?
The question appears on Johnson's computer.
Is that all?
As Metz shifts her eyes, Johnson stares at the screen.
No, it says locate covered switch, reading fuel valve emergency power.
Okay, got it.
Engage the switch.
Engage the switch? This doesn't feel right. Will you confirm that?
Sharon types, verify last transmission.
Just turn the damn...
Stratton heads through heavy rain in the cockpit.
John, they know what they're doing down there.
Yeah, I just wish I knew what I was doing up here. That's all.
He flips up the emergency power switch and presses a red button. The system controls go dark.
John!
The Stratton drops. In the cockpit, John presses the fuel buttons.
Get the fuel switch back on!
I am. It doesn't seem to make any difference. Autopilot's off. I have to take control. What is the altimeter saying?
32!
Make that 28! Keep calling it out every 500 feet!
Lightning flashes.
8,500 feet!
In the conference room, the survivors slide off their seats. The plane dives at Pacific Global.
How long before they're down?
They were dead the minute they switched off the engines.
In the cockpit.
2,500 feet!
Gotta reignite the engines! Somehow! Oh.
Feet a second.
2 minutes, we've got to find the reignition switch.
Where?
Somewhere within my reach.
As John frantically looks around, the plane speeds downward.
Can you see down here?
What
do you got? Hit him. Turn him on.
Sharon and John flip the switches and the panels light up.
Okay, Hill, hold on. I gotta get the nose up.
As Sharon braces herself, John grips the controls. The nose lifts slightly. The altimeter continues to drop.
Hang on!
We're Charlie out!
Hit the afterburners, the AVs!
Sharon rises and presses four buttons labeled AV. Outside, flames blast out of the rear engines. John pushes up the throttles.
500 feet!
The plane levels out. Sharon and the teenager grin.
I'm climbing!
The Stratton rises in the sky as it flies through the storm. In the cockpit, John's eyes widen.
You're flying.
Yeah, yes we are.
Sharon looks happily at the pilot. Now at Pacific Global, Johnson and Metz look at the data link screen. The executive types a message. Aboard the Stratton, John grits his teeth.
I still can't stabilize this thing. What's our altitude?
11,000 feet. That's where the autopilot was cruising.
Let's try it.
John hits a button.
Okay, come on.
He focuses ahead. As the plane levels, he releases the controls. The plane remains even in the sky. Sharon smiles.
Oh.
The teenage girl bends over.
Back in the comforting hands of technology.
Good flight.
Good co-pilot.
They gaze warmly at each other.
Whew.
Sharon checks the data link screen and furrows her brow.
Flight 52, do you read? Acknowledge. San Francisco headquarters. What's your status?
What's our status? We're still alive. No thanks to you.
John shakes his head.
Shutting down the fuel lines. What am I, an idiot?
Sharon's eyes shift. John glares at the screen. Another message appears. Do you read? Acknowledge. San Francisco HQ. Sharon checks the screen, then looks at John.
They don't want us back.
Why?
John glances at the teenager, then shifts his eyes pensively. He raises his brow.
I don't know. Maybe they don't think I can land this thing safely.
Maybe somebody screwed up and they're just trying to cover the tracks.
You know what? I don't really know why, and I don't really care. All I know is, we're on our own.
The teenager holds her hands clasped under her chin. John tightens his lips.
Let him think we're gone.
As he stares ahead intensely, the Stratton speeds through the sky. Now in the Stratton cockpit.
We don't have a lot of options. We're 45 minutes out from SFO. The autopilot can get us close, but sooner or later, we're on our own. I mean, I could put her down in the bay, and we might make it out, but what about the rest of the passengers?
I know the approach pretty well. I mean, not the technical end of it, but if it's clear, I can probably get you to the airport.
You can get us to the airport visually?
Yeah.
All right.
We better do something about these passengers first.
John looks back at the cabin. Now, at Pacific Global, Metz takes her briefcase and exits the data link room. As Johnson follows, Carson lifts a cell phone to his ear.
Miller here.
They've left.
In the control tower, Jack holds his cell.
Good. Now give me the last coordinates and headings for Flight 52.
He leans on the fatigue controller's station.
Right.
As they check a map, someone hands a document to the controller. Jack points to a spot on the map. Now a bright light blinks on a yellow life vest worn by Mrs. Stein. Her husband leans toward her.
We'll be home soon, my love.
He kisses her temple, then takes a seat beside her. In the chairs surrounding them, all the unconscious passengers wear flashing life vests. Mr. Stein dons his own. Up ahead, Sharon holds a flashlight under her arm. As the incoming air rustles the flight attendant's hair, she fastens a woman's seatbelt and double-checks the clasp on her life vest. Using the light, she inspects more passengers. In first class, the blonde teenager checks David's life vest. Now, at Pacific Global, Johnson and Metz enter a boardroom.
Ladies, gentlemen, it's been a hell of a day. I'll fill you in on everything that's happened. Now, most of you are familiar with Ann Metz from Beneficial. She's already briefed me on our liability situation. It isn't pretty.
In the cockpit.
The autopilot is going to get us to the outer marker, and then I'm going to have to take the controls. If I was a pro, I would fly right over San Francisco, out over Oakland, then circle back, and then come in and grab one of those runways by the bay.
John studies a map.
Oh, God, this is going to be hard.
Pilots say SFO is one of the hardest to land at.
I'm going to be flying over millions of people. I'm going to be fighting the Bay's crosswinds. I don't think I can do it.
Well, what if you try the straight-in approach?
This plane needs a lot of stopping room. The runways at SFO are just barely long enough to accommodate it, even with an experienced pilot. If we overshoot, we're going to go skidding right into the Bay.
And if you come in the correct way and go along, we run dead into the new Bay Center complex.
John and Sharon exchange concerned glances.
All right. You get us to the airport, and then we're going to drop down towards the Bay runway.
John eyes the map, then glances at Sharon.
Agreed?
Agreed.
Yeah. How will you know we're coming?
We're going to be showing up on their radar any minute now. They'll see us lumbering overhead. They'll figure it out.
Sharon releases a sigh. Now at Oakland Center, Marlene watches a radar screen.
We've located Pacific Global 52. We're going to head it off early and clear some airspace for you.
Roger, Oakland. We'll take it from here.
Here's that is your plan.
I knew they were alive.
An arrow moves on a radar screen.
This is air traffic control. Flight 52 is coming in. We need you to clear all the runways and scramble emergency crews.
Jack smiles at the controller, then stares at the moving image on the radar screen. Now, in the cockpit, John looks at a map in a binder. As he studies the page, the Stratton shakes. He looks up and sets the book down. Sharon enters with flashlights.
In case we end up in the water.
Oh, good idea.
Here you go.
You know, if we do land this thing, it's going to be next to impossible to prove someone tried to kill us.
Check this out.
Sharon presses a button labeled print, and paper feeds out of a slot near the teenager.
Now we have a record of every transmission sent and received since pre-flight.
Sharon passes a page to John.
Are you kidding me?
She grins slyly and fastens her seatbelt. The blonde teenager happily removes more pages and hands them to John. His face brightens.
Fantastic.
He points in Sharon's direction.
Let me see that flashlight for a second.
John turns on the light and holds it over the printout. Now, San Francisco's lit skyline stands against a red streaked sky. In the Pacific Global boardroom...
There's been no indication of a bomb. For all we know, it's possible that Flight 52 went down as a result of mechanical failure.
Or potentially a design flaw, which would lay this squarely at the feet of the Stratton people.
Flight 52 is on approach.
Johnson looks up at the messenger with a wrinkled brow. He shares a look with Metz.
Flight 52 is on approach. You all know what to do.
As Metz rises, she looks back at Johnson quizzically. He returns the puzzled look and follows her out. Now, the Stratton flies through the night sky. In first class, wind blows through David's hair. The unconscious co-pilot sways. In the cockpit.
Okay?
Yeah.
Here goes.
As John switches autopilot off, the plane shakes.
I see what you mean about the winds.
No, I don't think that's the problem.
What is it?
There's a device called the yaw damper. It takes the roll out of the flight. When the autopilot's on, it's working. You must have to manually engage it when it's off.
Was it on before?
Maybe when we restarted the engines, it reset the system. Or maybe it shorted out. I'm not sure.
Well, but what happens if we don't find it?
The roll will just get worse and worse. The wings dropping from side to side. I can deal with that up here, but when we get into the crosswinds for the landing, it's going to get much worse.
So when we land, we can hit the wing first?
John's eyes widen.
Let's find the yaw damper instead.
In the cabin, the passengers rock with the harsh movement. Mr. Stein holds his wife's hand.
I can't find anything marked as the yaw damper here.
Maybe it's on one of these panels that never came back up.
All right, well, even though they're not lit up, they may be doing something that's too risky to mess with it. Strap in, buckle up. We'll have to just go in without it.
The steering controls in front of Sharon shake back and forth. Now at the San Francisco control tower.
Hey, Jack?
The petite controller points to the radar.
That's some weird approach.
Yeah, but not bad for a weekend flyer. Found an outside marker and then flew in as the crow flies line toward us.
Well, if that's the way they're coming in, we need to clear them some room.
Guys, I think 10 is our best bet. Knock out the lights on all the other runways.
Show them the way home.
Outside, the lights in all but one runway go dark. In the cockpit.
They saw us coming in and got runway 10 threat.
Well, Sharon, give me the numbers.
3,000 feet.
In the sky, a damaged Stratton speeds ahead.
52's on final approach.
In the control tower, Jack looks through binoculars and spots their lights.
There you are.
In the cockpit.
2,700 feet.
Okay. John bites his lower lip.
Come on, straighten out.
Johnson and Met step behind Jack and the controller.
Not so lost after all, huh?
The exec swaps a worried look with Met. Outside, the Stratton draws closer to the runway. Johnson shakes his head.
He's coming in too hot.
In the cockpit, John knits his brow. In the conference room, the survivors hold hands.
500 feet!
Ready, Sheldon?
The pilot grips the throttles with one hand and the steering controls with the other.
Okay, here we go.
The teetering aircraft descends toward the runway. With its nose in the air, the Stratton's tail end grazes the runway first. As the survivors jostle inside, smoke rises from the plane's speeding tires. In the cabin, Mr. Stein holds his wife's hand firmly. In the conference room, papers fly around the survivors. Holding onto the throttles, John grimaces. As the plane speeds down the runway, sparks fly from the control panels. Beside John, Sharon jostles furiously. Outside, the nose dips and scrapes against the pavement. In the control tower, Jack and Johnson watch the landing. In the smoky cockpit, the struggling pilot holds the controls as sparks fly around him. Watching from the tower, the petite controller covers her mouth. Outside, flaming sparks engulf the Stratton's nose as it scrapes the runway. Bits of debris fly around past the unconscious passengers. As Sharon shields herself from the sparking panels, the plane heads straight for the bay. They stop inches from the water. John, Sharon, and the teenager take heavy breaths. In the conference room, Mickey and the flight attendant lift their gazes as Rachel grimaces. The other passengers remain still. Back in the cockpit.
Doing all right?
Yeah. I'm okay. I'll trigger the chutes.
Sharon heads out of the cockpit. Outside, flashing emergency vehicles race toward the Stratton. Using the flashlights, Sharon and the teenager enter the cabin. The flight attendant pulls on a lever and pushes the exit door open.
Let's get him out of here.
They walk to the back of the plane. In the control tower, Jack smiles. Johnson's brow furrows.
How the hell did they make it back? They didn't give up.
Jack looks at Metz, then taps fists with the petite controller. Johnson looks down. Now in the smoky cockpit, John searches for something. A fireman enters.
We've got a live one up here.
He grabs John.
Come on, you gotta get out of here now.
John points his unlit flashlight into the cockpit, then leaves. Meanwhile, as two rescuers attend to unconscious passengers, another leads the conference room survivors to an exit. Gripping the flashlight, John heads down to the cabin door and looks in on the safely landed passengers. With sweat glistening on his face, he leans against a wall beside the exit and closes his eyes. A relieved smile spreads on his lips. He jumps from the emergency exit and slides down the inflated chute. Paramedics meet him on the ground and help him to his feet. John looks back at the Stratton, then jogs away. As fire trucks hose down the plane, emergency crews attend to the passengers on stretchers. In the tower, the controller, Johnson, and Metz watch a TV news report.
Fire and rescue crews are on scene. They're in the process of transporting the survivors to nearby medical facilities.
John approaches the Steins.
Are they going to be okay?
Some better than others. We'll know more when we get them to a hospital.
You okay?
Mr. Stein nods.
Thank you.
As a paramedic attends to Mrs. Stein on a stretcher, John walks away and runs a hand through his hair. Nearby, two firemen carry the golden retrievers, alive and well, in their arms.
John!
Hey! You okay?
Yeah.
He hugs Sharon and the teenager.
How are you?
Okay.
Have you seen David?
He's gonna be okay.
Exactly what happened to the Stratton is still unclear, but its safe return is nothing short of a miracle.
The control tower crew claps.
We got more planes to get home, people.
As Metz shakes her head at the TV, Johnson steps up behind her.
He's an amateur pilot who survived a very traumatic experience. He's got no proof.
Johnson holds a tight frown.
No one will ever believe him.
The executive glares at Metz and walks away. The insurance agent glances his way, then turns back to the TV. now on the ground.
It's still underway.
Let me show you something.
As Sharon and the teenager watch, John unscrews his flashlight and removes the data link printout.
Is it a data link?
A complete record.
I bet we're gonna ruin somebody's night.
Big time.
John takes out his cell phone.
I'll be with you in a minute.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Hello.
As John heads off, Sharon checks the printout. The teenager smiles at her.
Well, are you ready to make some headlines?
I guess.
Come on, then.
Sharon puts her arm around her, and they head over to a group of reporters with John.
Nice flight.
What?
Thought you said you'd call when you landed.
You watching this?
It's on every channel, Dad.
Oh. You have no idea how glad I am to hear your voice.
As John grins, the emergency lights flash behind him. Beside the wreckage of Flight 52, rescuers attend to more survivors. Fade to black.